podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.
Really got a try on that left-hand side. What happened?
Oh, but I've gone up and over and he head over biscuit. It wasn't enough of stability there for myself, but no, I was busting for a bit of meat this game. It didn't seem to work out.
Hello, cheers, and welcome to the Scrum of the Earth podcast, the weekly show for news, reviews, great interviews, and so much more all about the world of rugby. My name is David Lawrence. I'm an American rugby fan who follows the game wherever I can find it all over the globe. If you'd like to get in touch, I'm easy to find on all your socials, and you can always just drop an email to thescrumoftheearth@gmail.com. Well, it was a fair amount of action this weekend, so why don't we get this show on the road? So starting as always with our current updates, and this week it's all about baseball here at Scrum HQ. My son, he finished up a few clinics in prep for the season, which starts this week, incredibly. And he's also doing a little baseball camp while he's off from school for April break, which is also this week. Plus, on top of all that, we've gotten our tickets for the Worcester Red Sox all lined up. That's always a blast. You know, for someone who doesn't really care about baseball, there's definitely a ton of it coming my way. Above all, though, it's just so gratifying to see my boy getting better and better and really just growing his love for the sport. Do I wish it was rugby rather than baseball? Sure, but am I incredibly grateful it's not hockey? Oh, my very yes.
It's too good. People have to know.
Yes, I'd say it is good news this week, and this is a bit of a follow-up story, actually, after the last Men's World Cup, where we reported that World Rugby were going after online abusers after the horrible things that were said and done in regards to the match officials and their families. So quoting here from Planet Rugby, quote, "A rugby fan in Australia has been convicted of sending online abuse to a match official during the 2023 Rugby World Cup. Aaron Isaiah, a 22-year-old New Zealand-born supporter living in Australia, pleaded guilty to one count of using a carriage service to menace or harass via online communication. Isaiah targeted television match official Brian McNeice following the World Cup clash between England and Samoa. The perpetrator sent abusive messages via Facebook to McNeice and his wife, reportedly mentioning their children after a decision went against the Pacific Islanders during their 18-17 defeat to the Red Rose. The defendant was handed a $1,000 12-month suspended fine by Australian authorities, and the decision has been welcomed by World Rugby. Quote, World Rugby welcomes this landmark outcome, Chief Executive Alan Gilpin said. The vile and toxic abuse is an all too common occurrence for many public figures, and we hope that this sends a very strong message to online trolls that such behavior is totally unacceptable and that the sport and the authorities are prepared to take action. We are delighted to be extending our relationship with Signify Group to tackle online abuse in our sport. In addition to the support provided to our match officials, the partnership has enabled us to focus on the insights that help us better understand the triggers, tactics, and threats and how best to mitigate them," unquote. The governing body teamed up with informational services company Signify during the World Cup to monitor social media abuse of officials, players, and teams. Signify flagged 1,600 accounts which breached community guidelines, leading to multiple pending prosecutions. World Rugby announced in January that a man in Australia had been charged and that there were several other cases ongoing in South Africa, France, New Zealand, Australia, and the UK. As a result, there could be many more convictions for match official abuse going forward, unquote. Well, I mean, it seems like a complete slap on the wrist punishment, but I'm just so surprised they were able to actually prosecute and then actually get a conviction. I mean, this has to be good news, right? Well, moving on to our thoughts of the week, and my thoughts this week are on the Pro de Deux. So this is a competition I actually have no way to watch here. I do hope that changes at some point. Of course, my life might be over at that point. So quoting here from a little article I saw on Rugby Pass, quote, "The Pro de Deux is rugby's land of opportunity. The French second tier has become a perfect stepping stone for those with potential to become star players, no matter their national allegiance. It is a tournament laden with history, from the rustic rural stadia to the fanatical support and populated by rising luminaries from across the world. Local talent flows through the competition, of course. Melvin Jaminet is now a fully-fledged French international. Nathaniel Hulu, I think, has stepped up emphatically from Van to Cast in the top 14 this season. And then Antoine, I have never heard this name pronounced, Okanya, maybe, could be the next off the conveyor belt after an impressive campaign with Orillac, I suppose. Wow, I probably should have checked on some of these before starting to read them. But around this French corps, a rich blend of international athletes thrives. Men from as far and wide as Algeria, USA, Samoa, Portugal, and the Cook Islands ply their trade in the Pro de Deux, earning crucial sporting and cultural experiences and often climbing to bigger things. The Pro de Deux can be their golden ticket. Raphael Storti's case is a perfect example of how the league pushed a burgeoning young player to break. After failing to make the Stade Français first team, the Portugal flying machine was loaned to Béziers, and in 2 years became one of the most prolific try scorers of the competition, earning himself a new contract with the Parisian Giants. Storti leads this season's try scoring charts with an incredible 20 in 17 games, unquote. So the article obviously goes on a bit after that. So if you are curious, just follow the link in the show notes. As always, definitely a cool little read. Okay, moving on to our reviews, and the Women's Six Nations was back in full swing. This week, we began with Scotland at home for England. Much as I feared, it was not pretty. I felt sure the Red Roses were going to win, but I was really hoping Scotland would, you know, show some tough D, maybe keep the scoreline reasonable, maybe pour in a couple of scores of their own, but, well, no. It kind of went from bad to worse. Scotland shut out by 17 at the break and then shut out entirely 0-46 by the double whistle. The try list for England, it looks like an all-star team roster with household names like Amy Cocaine, Abby Dow, and the aptly named Jess Breach, who nabbed a brace. Ellie Kildon also got a pair with Sadia Kabea, I think. And you guessed it, Marley Packer rounding out the scoring list. The Red Roses far more than doubled the home team's meters gained, posted an unreal 41 defenders beaten. That is frightening. In some ways, Scotland were their own worst enemy, squandering their meager 38% possession by turning it over a whopping 18 times. England, they look fully loaded at this point, but I am optimistic Scotland will bounce back at least a little bit next week. So, Ireland, they were hosting Wales once again at halftime. Looked like we might be in for another shutout. The Irish looking strong and leading 21-0. Gwennon Hopkins finally got a try for Wales with about a quarter hour left in the match, but Ireland, they were in full control for the full 80, just smashing their guests 36-5 by the end. Ireland's five tries went to five different players. Dana O'Brien actually added a penalty kick, something that hasn't happened much this Six Nations. The stat that really popped out for me, though, was Ireland's meters carried, which, not even kidding, surpassed 1,000. I just wonder how often I've even seen a game where that happened over the years. Oh my gosh. So Wales, they have two more shots to get a win this tournament, but I gotta say, it's not looking particularly good. On Sunday, our fixture was France versus Italy. Went much how you'd expect. If the game was only the second half, though, it would have been a draw, but the damage had already been done. France racking up a 38-15 victory in Paris. France spread their six tries out between six players, including Madusu Fall, while Elisa Dinka scored both of Italy's. Italy actually had more carries, more meters gained, and more defenders beaten, and France were far from perfect, again giving away 16 turnovers and committing 20 handling errors. Wow. Those stats would really sound in a bubble like the team that must have lost, but this is France, and I mean, we'll see how that kind of play works out when they face England on the 27th. In the meantime, France and England remain unbeaten. Ireland, Italy, and Scotland each have that single win, and Wales are stuck sitting on the goose egg. Meanwhile, in the EPCR, we got stuck into the quarterfinals. How great is that? I know I'm in the minority here, but I love the European Cups, both of them. And regardless of how dim-witted the format might be on any given year, it's just a fact that we get teams, in some cases, you've literally never seen play each other, which is utterly fascinating. Or you get teams that have met in these very tournaments and have painful, bruising histories. So, you know, once we get to the knockouts, I am just all in, no matter what. So, in the Heineken Cup, we started with Bordeaux Begle at home for Harlequins. After listening to all the experts this week, I was really expecting a bit of a blowout, to be fair. It was an absolutely gorgeous day out. The comms told us that the Quins' mantra for this one was, quote, swing the bat, unquote. And they certainly came out with attitude, quickly getting the first try of the day. It didn't take long before a deliberate knock-on by my Border Beagles gave their guests a penalty try. Before 10 minutes had passed, Harlequins were up 14 and a player. Quote, the volume difference from the crowd is dramatic, said the comms, and they are completely stunned here in Bordeaux, unquote. I started to feel like the crowd clearly did. It felt like every slightly forward pass by Bordeaux was instantly called, while the Harlequins, they seem to be working with a much looser definition of what constitutes flat. The heat, of course, was playing a part, but with even the likes of last week's Diamond in the Rough winner Louis Bielvalet clutching his shorts as he tried to refill his lungs, it was 12-28 at halftime. It was almost like watching any professional game in Philadelphia, where, like, if the home team isn't way on top, the fans completely turn on them. Side note, I mentioned last week, this game was always going to be weird for me, as it pitted the team I support in the top 14 against the team I like in the Prem. So it was a strange experience. I found myself supporting whichever team was behind at any given moment. Harlequins go up, I'm like, no, come on, Bordeaux. And then they regain the lead, and I'm like, no, come on, Quins, we got this. I don't know. I feel like that says something about my personality, but I probably shouldn't try too hard to figure out exactly what. Anywho, my guy, Alex Donbrandt, he scored to extend the Quins lead midway through the second half, and the comms shouted, in a game like this, count no chickens. Still kind of chewing on that one. Ubebe looked like he was slipping away, and to be fair, the crowd had mostly abandoned them. Louis Bielvalet, he scored to wake things up a bit. And by the way, I think I just cracked it. If the team is Ubebe, this young man should be Lubebe. Yeah? Just saying. So an unbelievable breakaway try to Tomboy got the home team in front for the first time. And the slightly two-faced crowd was back in full voice. It was breathless stuff. Marcus Smith may or may not have lost his mind completely at one point, but a very controversial bit ensued where Quins looked to have stepped into touch uncalled, then committed a pretty clear forward pass, also unnoticed, and got a try to regain the lead with only maybe 5 minutes left. Not a good look from where I sat. Bordeaux, they did score to come within a point, but Luku shockingly muffed the conversion. Harlequins were able to squeak it out, an incredible 41-42 final score. And this was the first game in the Champions Cup? Are you kidding me? That, of course, was followed by a rematch of last year's final. It was Leinster facing off against the reigning champions and Irish scourge La Rochelle, though all the pundits this year had written off the visitors before they even finished their little whirlwind tour of Cork. La Rochelle, they looked confident but couldn't get out of their own 22. It was crazy, the pressure they were under from the get-go, and just nothing seemed to alleviate it. It was like a beach versus the tide or something. As the home team got the first points of the match, the comms mentioned, well, last year, La Rochelle were down 17-0 after 12 minutes, so they've got to be pretty happy right now, but I was not convinced. So a huge decision at the end of the first half, with La Rochelle going for the corner to try to get back into it, down 23-6 at that point. I appreciated the aggression, but doubted the sanity, all while, of course, loving the spectacle. The second half saw the table shifting markedly in the home team's favor. Entering the final quarter of the match, they looked pretty safe, 35-13. I was just picturing Ronan O'Gara like smashing every table and chair in the coaching booth like a Lego video game. So a James Lowe try seemed to break the spirit of La Rochelle, and they never really recovered from that. Leinster fans would at last have something to celebrate, at least for the nonce. A massive result at the Aviva, and the Monkey thoroughly off their collective back, 40-13. I have to think it's possible Leinster get themselves a double this year. It was a blistering performance. Also on Saturday, Northampton Saints were at the cinch for the Bulls, who were a tad miffed about what they saw as highly inequitable travel arrangements. And they sent a squad that reflected their dissatisfaction. The assumption seemed to be, screw this European nonsense, we are gearing up to take the URC. Outlets like the Telegraph railed against this, saying it dented the credibility of the Champions Cup. And, you know, I don't usually get that up in arms about these things, but I admit it was a bit of a letdown to see they had made 13 changes and left Springboks like Willie LaRue and Kurt Lee Aarons at home to watch. The Saints, of course, likely had no issues at all with this decision. So, despite the comms spending the entire first half telling us just how much the Saints would be enjoying their trip to the semis, it was only 28-22 at the halftime. What an upset that could be, but no. The Bulls only had maybe 50 minutes in them. The home team ran away with it after that. The visitors unable to score another point in the second half, and a downbeat result. Northampton smashing the team in front of them, as they say, 59-22. And then finally on Sunday, we had Toulouse versus the stupid Exeter Chiefs. For once, I was very much rooting for a blowout. What a day it was, however. The teams looked very evenly matched, but a sliding doors moment might have been just past a quarter hour, where not only did Toulouse not get a penalty I thought they deserved, it went all the way in the other direction. A yellow card coming out and a quick try reply from the visitors. After the conversion, the crowd had entirely switched from any semblance of cheering to just a continuous cacophony of boos and derision. An oddly beautiful sound, I have to say. So Jack Willis slowly got his way through, like, I don't know, like a glacier crossing a line of latitude, keeping us on the edge of our seats. Surely Exeter aren't so good they could come to Toulouse and steal a quarterfinal. Side note, and I'm going to borrow a phrase from what the pundits say when they talk NFL. Whenever there's a player of, let's say, you know, questionable repute, they will say, well, say what you will about so-and-so. Like, you know, you can say a lot of things about Ben Roethlisberger, but the guy has a heck of an arm. In honor of that rhetorical template, I'm going to say what you will about Henry Slade, but the guy has a great head of hair. So 17-16 was the score at halftime. Exeter went back up with yet another Slade penalty. But you know what I love about Toulouse? They're so confident, so sure in what they do. They know how to make the clock your enemy at all times, even when you're playing well. Kinghorn, for instance, every conversion, he took like 80 or 82 seconds out of the available 90, even when it was smack dab directly in front. And I love that. It has a weird way of adding pressure on you, even when they're behind. They're just such an experienced team. It's so much fun. So when the score later became 45-19 before he'd even entered the final quarter of play, everyone in the entire stadium knew it was over, and so did we, the viewers. When Juan Cruz Malia got through right at the end, it would go into the books as an all-time hiding. The comms said, quote, all 13 home games this year have been won, and the record extends to 34 straight games, unquote. I admit I didn't double check any of that, but it seems as insane as it does believable. Final score to close out the Champions Cup quarterfinals, 64-26. Did I just imagine that? Okay, in the Michelob Ultra Cup, Gloucester were at home for the Ospreys. These clubs had met 8 times since 2003, with Gloucester edging the head-to-head series 5-3, but they had not faced each other in 6 years when the Premiership outfit won 43-20 at this very site. It was bad news right at the top as I realized Austin Healey was on comms for this one. All through the Challenge Cup, we've been blessed with silence on comms, and now this? Oy vey. So Keelan Giles got the visitors their first try of the night. That made it a dozen Challenge Cup tries for him. But to me, at least, both teams just kind of looked nervous. It felt like this game meant a lot to both sides, and they were just really slow getting a grip on things. Tipperick, he was having a great game, I thought. But when his team got marched back for getting lippy with the ref, kind of worried it was a sign of things to come. Nevertheless, it was 14-13 at the break and anyone's game. Two kicks from Santi Carreras accounted for the only points in the third quarter of play. As I said, I was worried about some sort of meltdown that never came from Ospreys, but neither did any more points, and just a bit of a letdown. An exit with more of a whimper than a bang. And what is even up with Gloucester? This competition seems to have taken up the entirety of their team focus for this year, and even I have to admit, like, it's working. 23-13 was your final score at King's Home. Saturday, we had Claremont versus Ulster. After 15 minutes, Ulster were up 7-0, and the comms said, quote, Claremont certainly don't have to panic, and then as they gave away a foolish penalty, but they will, unquote. However, Peter Gus-Saukula, he had the answer as he sliced through untouched. The comms mentioned how odd it was to see him scoring without smashing through two or three bodies. They were in great form, you know. In fact, if any of you know who the woman was on the lead comms, please let me know. She was great. And of course, they never mentioned it or showed her name in the broadcast I saw here. So speaking of great, Claremont looked very good. Two bang-bang tries just into the final quarter. Looked to put it completely out of reach. The Ulster players looked like they had just thrown in the towel. Very dispirited look, and it seemed to embody this whole weird season for them. Claremont, they poured it on a bit as the opposition splintered apart, and by the end, it was a complete beatdown, 53-14. Down in South Africa, Sharks were hosting Edinburgh in Durban, and after all I just said about, you know, all these nice things I said about the comms for the Claremont versus Ulster match, I did have one complaint, which was they actually referenced this game, the other game that was happening at the same time. Very late, they said, well, the Sharks look to be well in control. I'm like, dude, some of us are going to watch the replays. Rough, but, you know, it was their only bad from their performance otherwise. Anyway, newly arisen Ben Healey slotted 3 to give his team the lead at halftime, but those would be the last points Edinburgh would get until the 75th minute, and by then it was over. A valiant effort from the visitors, but in the end, the Sharks have found themselves at just the right time to spoil multiple seasons for the unsuspecting. This time, it was Sharks 36, Edinburgh 30. And then finally, on Sunday, we closed out the quarterfinals with Benetton hosting my Connacht team. They said at the top, both teams had agreed to skip water breaks. And I have to say, even at that moment, I really questioned that decision by Connacht. I understand there's a push for that in terms of making crowds happier, but it was really hot in Treviso, and your goal is to win, right? Why give away an advantage? Benetton are more used to that environment. Surely it helps Connacht more than them to have a break or two, right? Anyway, I don't know if that had anything to do with it, but Connacht didn't have a great game. You know, when the likes of Bundy Aki are knocking the ball on and making mistakes, you know you're in for a tough day. The comms described their ongoing litany of errors as, quote, endless, unquote. Benetton, they looked quite good. Jacob Umanga was having a bit of a howler off the boot, but they would win and advance to face Gloucester in the semis, hoping to make the first ever appearance for an Italian club in the finals. 39-24 was your final score in the European comps for this weekend. So much fun. Okay, switching gears a bit. In Super Rugby Alpiki, we had reached the 2024 Grand Final, which featured the Blues women at home for the Chiefs women, a rematch of the teams that faced off in the inaugural season back in 2022 in the final. It was an incredible match. I'm just going to quote here from the official website to start. Quote, the Blues are Super Rugby Alpiki champions for the first time after an improbable Herculean 24-18 victory over Chiefs Manawa at Eden Park. With 15 minutes remaining, ominous clouds became unremitting rain, and the hosts were down 5-18, wobbling towards the canvas. What followed was a genuine Houdini act, sparked from a most precocious source. Kalia Awa, in her season debut, produced a cameo so assured and influential it might pique the interest of Black Ferns selectors, unquote. So Ruby Tui, she had a great game for the Manawa, a side loaded with internationals, and at 5-8 in the intermission, it looked really up for grabs. With only a quarter hour of play, as they kind of mentioned, Blues down 13 and getting nothing in the second half. It really felt like it was over, but that comeback came fast and furious from then on. With less than 4 minutes to go, the heavens completely opened up. The Blues found one final score to snatch the victory, an unbelievable performance by them. If you didn't have a chance to watch this competition this year, you're going to want to find a way to next year. It just gets better and better. Congratulations to the Blues, who become the third winner in 3 years. Could the Hurricanes Pua be next? Over in Super Rugby Pacific, it was round eight. We only had four fixtures once again, as we're in the middle of bye season. This week, it kicked off with Moana Pacifica getting another home-away-from-home game, this time at Seminoff Stadium in Whangarei against the Reds. A guy got tackled, and this is crazy, because it wasn't a player. It was Angus Mabey. And as he got up, the comms pointed out, I think I might have done that joke before, by the way. The comms pointed out that he was picking grass out of his teeth and said, it shouldn't be as funny as it is. And yeah, I am with you. Anyway, bad game for the Reds. So many mistakes. It was 10-0 at halftime. The Reds, you know, give them credit. They fought back. They looked to have taken the lead, but it was called back for a really dumb red card by McDermott. More reckless nonsense. Just not a couple of good weeks for discipline in the old Super Rugby. Right on cue, Fraser McWright got himself sent off with another red card. Is this like the theme this week or something? We had the kids round, we had super round. Is this red card round? So in response, the nominal home team went ahead for good through a try from Havili. What a weird game. Yet another one where one team just gave it away through insane blunders. But homeless Moana Pacifica were jumping for joy to secure their third win in a season for the first time ever. A nice feat, given their forced nomadic nature. 17-14 was an exciting final score. That was followed by Waratahs taking on the Crusaders. They spent most of the time in the lead-up to this one talking about the famous Waratahs team from 2014. For me, it was hard to see many parallels to this squad. For the last couple of weeks, one of the Aussie pods I listened to has been absolutely hammering the Tahs for not making any changes, especially among the backs, as they've been consistently underperforming, but there have been no consequences. The way they put it, the coaches have effectively been like, okay, that was a completely unacceptable performance. You may have cost us a really close game. Here's your 15 jersey for next week. So to their credit, the coaches did make a change, this time ignominiously dropping Nwagana Tinawase, who didn't look sad about it at all, smiling and laughing it up in his civvies in the stands. His is turning into a bit of a bummer story, eh? In any case, not sure if it was the shakeup or just what, but the Tahs looked thoroughly pumped, really made it a great contest. The lead seesawing back and forth seven times just in the first half, though they eschewed a chance to nab another easy three right at the hooter. Would that choice come back to haunt them, to up just 1 point rather than four? So what a game. It turned into a bonkers ending. Crusaders, they went up by three at the very end, but because they took the kick 2 seconds before the clock read 80 minutes, they had to do a restart. In the ensuing play, they gave away a yellow card that led to Will Harrison slotting a pen to send it to Golden Point, of which I am not a fan, by the way, but we can talk about that some other time. But with an extra player on the field, the Taz just marched on down. It was Will Harrison again, this time with a nervy drop goal to win it for the home side and send the SFS into hysteria. Even the Prime Minister standing and cheering. What a scene. Very compelling match, all in all. The Crusaders were left to go punch their lockers in frustration for a season gone horribly wrong. 43-40 was the final score after 12 lead changes and an instant classic for New South Wales. Both those matches were as Thursday turned into Friday where I am, and then in the wee small hours of Saturday morning. It was Hurricanes versus Chiefs. I was very excited for this one. TJ was getting the start, as he will be for the foreseeable future with the loss of Cam Røygaard. And his Canes got on the board first. I was expecting a shootout in this one, but after 20 minutes, it was just 10-7 and 17-13 at the break. But it felt like it might blow up at any moment. So the visitors absolutely starved their hosts of possession in the second half, got their first lead with maybe a half hour or so to go. But Brett Cameron, one test All Black, rose to the challenge, got his team back in front with a nervy conversion late in the match. The Chiefs kind of ran out of gas after that. Hurricanes were more than happy to take advantage, building their lead and closing things out convincingly. A 36-23 final score. They cemented themselves as the leading team in this year's competition. What a game. After that, the Rebels hosted by Highlanders at Amy Park. To paraphrase Han Solo, I had a bad feeling about this. Sure enough, the Rebels ran out to an early lead and put an exclamation mark next to it with a try right at the halftime hooter to make it 26-10. But at least the Comms weren't actively making me feel bad for supporting my team this time. The visitors managed to rack up three converted tries in the second half, but the Rebs, they were on a mission, came away big winners, 47-31. Side note, by the way, the word is a rich Aussie's pulling together a consortium that will save the Rebels franchise. And from what I hear, looks pretty certain to happen. So more news on that as I hear it, of course. And of course, back home in the MLR, we had my beloved Free Jacks on the road to Houston. I'm just going to come out and admit it. I had this one penciled in as a loss for us. I mean, you can't win every single game. We'd already shown some vulnerability against the wishy-washy DC team. So I figured a road trip to the unbeaten Thundercats might be an L for us. However, I was quite pleased to be wrong once again, as my guys really dialed in and won, racking up 47 points over the Cats 35. Coach Matthew will be irate that we let three tries in during the latter stages of the match. That is definitely a habit we need to rid ourselves of, but Wayne Vanderbank got his third try of the night to put it in the books. Vian Conradi had another great game. Jason Patras continues to steer the ship unerringly, and a few newer players are also starting to really come into form as the season progresses. By the way, if anyone from Rugby Morning is listening, I expect there to be at least one big change at the top of the pecking order on the old MLR Power Rankings Tabulator 5000 this week. Oh, and final note, Mitch Jacobson was back with us for the first time this season, slotted right into the captain's role. Really, really great to have him back. What a player. Elsewhere, Dallas versus Utah turned into a really good one. I came in very late, but I found the Jackals down just three and driving in those closing minutes. With 15 seconds to go, Dallas drove over the line to snatch the win. Really encouraging sign for them, taking down the Warriors 22-20. San Diego versus NOLA was another home win for the Legion, who are still too scared to come out here to Fort Quincy, by the way. They took down the Gold 33-20. The Second City Pups welcomed the stupidly named Anthem, and it was another day out behind the woodshed for the visitors, who will remain winless. It was 59-26. And finally, the LA team got a visit from the Seawolves of Seattle, and the Bellends had one of their poorest outings of the season, losing 5-36 to wrap up this weekend in the MLR. By that music, you'll know it's time for this week's Diamond in the Ruck Award, and this week, the award goes to Ifo Wafer. Ms. Wafer, your try to open the match against Wales this weekend was a thing of beauty, shedding at least two would-be tacklers on your way in, and really inspired your team to their first win of the tournament. It was a victory that ended a seven-game losing streak and showed the world how far your team has come in just a year. Ifo Wafer, congratulations to you, for you are this week's Diamond in the Ruck. Well done. That brings us to our updates and previews. It looks like another incredible weekend of rugby all over the world. In the Women's Six Nations on Saturday, it'll be England at home for Ireland, followed by Italy hosting Scotland. On Sunday, it's Wales at Cardiff Arms Park to take on France to close out this year's penultimate round. Bye week season continues in Super Rugby Pacific, so our four offerings in round nine will be the Fijian Drua in Suva, in fact, to take on the unbeaten Hurricanes. Wow, that's going to be fun. Reds will happily welcome my sad and misfiring Highlanders to Suncorp Stadium. Then, possibly the game of the week, the Blues will be taking on the Brumbies. Really tasty. And then finally, the Western Force are back in Perth for the stumbling Crusaders. Back in the URC on Friday, Ulster take on Cardiff, and Glasgow host the Sharks. Really be interested to see what kind of squad travels up there this time. On Saturday, Lions are home for Leinster. Benetton hosts the Dragons. The Bulls face Munster. Ooh, that's going to be dicey. Stormers are home for Ospreys. Connacht are back in Galway for Zebre. And Edinburgh face the Scarlets at the Hive. Over in the top 14, we'll have Cast versus La Rochelle. Oyonnax versus Racing. Perpignan versus Lyon. Stade Francais versus Bayonne. Po versus Montpellier. And then we'll have, I'm going to call it a twofer, Toulon versus Toulouse. All of that stuff is on Saturday. Sunday brings us my very disappointed Bordeaux Beg, who are home for Clermont. In the Premiership, we'll have three on Saturday and two on Sunday. It'll be Saracens versus Gloucester, Northampton versus Leicester, Exeter versus Bath, Sale versus Harlequins, and Bristol Bears versus the hapless Newcastle Falcons. And then here at home, it is the Mixtape Festival at Fort Quincy for my beloved Free Jacks, who are taking on the Seawolves from Seattle. It's going to be a tough one, but I can't wait. Elsewhere, NOLA take on Miami. DC are home for the Thundercats. The Pups get to stay at the Doghouse for the team from Los Angeles. And San Diego hosts the rugby team of Latter-day Saints. Should be a great weekend. Well, my friends, that does it for another week. And as always, I'm a bit bummed that we don't get to keep rolling with the European comps for the next 2 weeks. I just never get used to the schedule. Quarterfinals, then 2 weeks off. Semifinals, 3 weeks off. Quit jerking us around already, will ya? Anyway, to all of you across the globe, cheers. Talk to you soon. And of course, be well.
It gives me great pleasure to be here today.
All right, doesn't he? Sports Social Podcast Network.